Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Our topic today is the future of healthcare. Joining us today are Dr. Ben Barr, Dr. Cherry Beasley, Chancellor Robin Cummings, and Dr. Shilpa Reagan. Your host for 30 Brave Minutes is Dr. Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Healthcare is a $3 trillion industry in America today that employs millions and represents about 18% of the total U.S. economy. Healthcare expenditures by person have risen 65 times in the last half century. By comparison, if a loaf of bread had risen similarly, it would cost $17. A gallon of gas, about $20. But the news is not all discouraging. Life expectancy in this country has risen to 79 years of age, in large part due to innovations of research, the skill and techniques employed by doctors and nurses, and improvements in access for people needing mental health treatment. UNCP is a player in healthcare as well, with thriving programs in nursing, research tracks in biology and chemistry, counseling, social work and psychology programs, athletic training, healthcare management administration, as well as partnerships with various universities and programs ranging from veterinary medicine to physical therapy. Our topic for today, the future of healthcare. Dr. Ben Barr holds the William C. Friday Chair in the Departments of Biology as well as Chemistry Physics. He has over 140 publications on Alzheimer's disease as well as other brain disorders and has been actively researching the disease for years. Welcome, Ben.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
How has the research process in Alzheimer's changed over the last several years? Do you think we're gaining confidence or just understanding how challenging it really is?
Well, our understanding of the brain changes almost daily. And the brain's incredibly challenging because there's so many features to it. And even with Alzheimer's disease, the feeling about the disease changes 5 or 10 years. Almost everything we thought we understood gets flipped on its head as we find more things about the brain. If you think about it, you have a 500,000 gigabyte hard drive floating in your skull that can make people laugh, it can write poetry.
Mine might be a little smaller.
It put people on the moon to be very proud of that brain you have. And we might just be scratching the surface about the complexities that's up there. But we're learning more and more, and we're hoping we can solve this terrible disease.
Thanks. Dr. Cherry Beasley is the inaugural Belk Endowed Professor for Rural and Minority Health at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. Her areas of expertise are cultural roles of healthcare decision-making, rural health, diabetes, nursing workforce issues, and women's health. Welcome, Cherry.
Hi.
How are nurses being educated differently now as opposed to just a few years ago when you were an undergraduate?
Just a few years ago, actually more than 40. However, what we've seen is a phenomenal change in nursing education. Probably most people think of nurses being trained in hospitals, schools of nursing, using what was then an apprentice model. You were taught to do, not to think and make a decision. In the way we educate nurses today, however, nursing is now known as a human science, where we have to blend science and art to gather data, make a decision, and then help influence human response. That's really what nurses do. They look at human response to dilemmas, physical, emotional, as well as environmental, which we just went through. So that's our job.
How significant is that? I mean, how different is a nurse's daily job now than it was just as recently as a decade ago?
Several things have changed. One of the things that nursing has done as a profession has said that we will have a social policy statement that looks at what when society changes, nursing will also change. And so now some of the driving forces in how we educate nurses or how nurses practice is looking at what knowledge has to be integrated to take care of a patient. We have some things that will never change in nursing, hopefully. The caring concept, the compassion, ethical comportment, being skilled at what we do. But when you approach a patient now, you have to look at the patient's genetic profile. You have to look at the social determinants of health, their economic profile. You have to look at what they desire. Are they looking for cure or is well-being more what their interest is? So at the bedside, a nurse has to be able to integrate all those things at one time and still deliver care in a compassionate manner.
Making hundreds of decisions in a split
every day.
Second.
Every day. So one of the courses we have to teach is critical thinking. How do you make a clinical decision?
And that really is something that translates into all of your different mm-hmm. disciplines. You know, making informed decisions, sifting data, making judgments, and then taking action. Dr. Robin Cummings spent 2+ decades in the operating room as a cardiothoracic surgeon. He has directed providers, run the Medicaid department for the state of North Carolina, has been involved in seemingly every level of healthcare, and now, thankfully, serves UNCP as its 6th chancellor. Welcome, Dr. Cummings.
Welcome. Good to be here.
As a cardiothoracic surgeon, how rapidly did you see OR techniques and surgical techniques change due to advancements in research, technology, best practices?
So cardiac surgery, more so than most other areas of surgery, is one that really is dependent upon technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about the fact that you're going to stop someone's heart, how do you keep that person alive during that period of time? And so that's because we now have something called a bypass machine. Bypass machine because it bypasses your heart while it keeps the rest of your body going, and I can operate on the heart. But to create that machine, it was just an incredible story about technology. And a lot of patients lost their life, to be honest with you. Heart surgery actually was one of those fields where at one point you could have a 200% mortality. You could lose the patient plus someone else. And that was because in the past, the way we would bypass a patient is we would connect you to another patient.
Wow.
That patient's heart would beat, keep you going while I stop your heart. Well, we didn't even know about blood types at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you could end up with two people not alive at the end of the day. But thankfully, the bypass machine was started. Gibbons, a gentleman, created it back in the 1950s, did a great job. A lot of people think he should get a Nobel Prize for that, but he never did. So today, the bypass machine does an incredible amount of work. Now, having said that, when I finished my training in 1992, within the next year, there was this idea about doing minimally invasive surgery came about. And that's the idea of doing surgery not through splitting your chest, mm-hmm. as we say, opening your chest completely up. Now people are saying, well, why can't you make that small incision and get to my heart that way, and using cameras and video and so forth. So when I finished, within about a year, I was behind.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to actually go back to different courses and take different courses, which is not uncommon in surgery, to learn how to use the technology that was available at that time. Bypass, the heart operation has progressed to the point now that really you have it and you go home in 3 to 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible feat. It's a testament to American ingenuity, to our medical system. It's expensive. It costs a lot, as you referred to earlier, but it really does deliver incredible, incredible results.
And when the benefit is extending life decades, you know, the cost is really, you know, put in proper perspective.
So one of my greatest joys in life still is patients coming up, and it seems like I get them in batches of 3 or 4 that they'll come up on different days of the week and just say, well, I know you don't remember me, and then they'll say, you operated in such and such a time. And I've met many of my patients who are 20 years plus now down the road and who look healthy and doing well.
That's amazing. Dr. Shilpa Regan is an associate professor of clinical psychology who has been teaching at UNCP for the last 12 years. Her research interests focus on how cultural factors influence the conceptualization, treatment, and help seeking of mental disorders. Her main passion, thankfully for us, is working with students. Good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Mental health services, sort of broadly construed, are among the most rapidly changing processes associated with healthcare. Is it easier now, or in some ways more difficult, for clients to get the services they need?
Unfortunately, the numbers are indicating it still remains difficult to have access. You have 18 to 24-year-olds not seeking services compared to older individuals. 1 in 3 older adults doesn't receive services, and 1 out of 10 children and adolescents have a mental health problem, and under 50% of them are not receiving services. And those numbers are even worse for people of color, for people from rural areas and people of low SES. And so in trying to look at why is this occurring, it's not stigma. Historically, the reason why people didn't access services is because of the stigma. They did not want to admit they had a mental health issue. But that's not it anymore. It's two reasons. It's affordability and it's access, right? Even with the Affordable Health Care Act in place, people still aren't receiving appropriate treatment. It is, what's occurring is it's too expensive or there's not enough mental health care providers. And that's what we're seeing right now.
And the conditions in mental health, are they like a physical health situation to where if it's not treated, the situation gets progressively worse?
It can, absolutely. Individuals, especially if they have mild to moderate symptoms, we know if you do not treat them, the severity will increase. And when that occurs, you have individuals with increased suicidality. You have individuals entering then higher incarceration rates. So it affects a large part of society.
Thank you for listening to 30 Brave Minutes and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. If you want to support students and to help make events and programs like this one possible, please consider our contribution to the College of Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, state, the region, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, research, and scholarship of the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Mark your envelope, the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNC Pembroke, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372. Or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to more 30 Brave Minutes.
Talk about the new directions where healthcare appears to be headed in the next decade in each of your fields.
Well, I'll start. This is Cherry Beasley. In nursing, and I think it's really just healthcare in general, we're looking for a system that is safe, because safety is a major issue in our healthcare delivery system, has high quality and affordability, and also treats the entire patient. So it's not just a physical, that patient who has a heart issue that also is probably also going to have a mental health concern, because health is so totalitarian as a spirit. So it's not just keeping it physical and then doing something mental. And because, matter of fact, we know if a person has two chronic diseases, their chance of being depressed is 50%. Mm-hmm. So what percentage of the people that we take care of in rural North Carolina have diabetes and hypertension? And so, therefore, are they getting access to all the services that they need? And those services need to be safe and affordable.
What about the rest of y'all? Where do you see your disciplines, your areas moving?
New fields are opening up with regard to brain research. It's hard to keep up. You're made of more non-human cells than you are of human cells, so the microbiome is a new field, and NIH wants researchers to try to figure out how the microbiome, the bacteria in your gut, mm-hmm. is affecting the brain, your risk factor for Alzheimer's. And individualized medicine is the big deal. You mentioned genomics, so pharmacogenomics, your genomic makeup that might affect your risk of disease and how drugs affect you. Those are all new fields that we try to expose our students to, but sometimes the fields are growing faster than we can even gather the information.
Is there enough money in research, or is it that we need more and we need more time in order to get to the answer to some of these questions?
Yes. There's always a race for research, so we're always looking for dollars, and NIH has lots of money for Alzheimer's, but we're competing with the big labs. So I look for all types of funding through companies, through small organizations.
What about in mental health? Where do you see that moving in the next handful of years?
Earlier I alluded to a lack of treatment, especially in rural areas and low SES. They're looking at telemental health now, using technology and video conferencing and cell phones. So you have increasing a number of workshops on that to look at the ethics and the legality of being able to do that. So I do see them using technology now in the field to get to the populations we can't get to.
So in one area, when I was in Medicaid, one thing we did that I'm very proud of is we set up something called a statewide telepsychiatry program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the General Assembly gave us $2 million. And the idea being that you've got a lot of small hospitals out there that you don't have a psychiatrist, you don't have anyone qualified to make a call on a patient coming in with a behavioral health issue. And we had hospitals calling saying, you're telling me to cut my Medicaid calls, yet I've got a patient that's been sitting here for 60 days, no exaggeration, 60 days in my emergency room. I've got a nurse tied to that patient. I've got a sheriff sometimes tied to that patient mm-hmm. because they can get mm-hmm. violent, and I can't get a disposition on the patient. So East Carolina's done some really neat stuff with telemedicine, and we teamed with East Carolina. And by doing that, we were able to supply with this $2 million each hospital the equipment, the video equipment that they would need. So their goal was to set their what they had to do was to set aside a room. We would put the equipment in there. You'd bring the patient in. The nurse would take the vital signs, take down an initial history, and then would communicate with a psychiatrist sitting at East Carolina. The equipment they used was just incredible. It could watch you across the room and see your pupils dilate, constrict. It could watch wow. and see you sweating. So if the patient, you know, there's a lot of that that goes on when you're evaluating sure. a patient, as you know. And so I checked with someone recently, and of the, I think, 140 hospitals, 90 to 100 of them now have that ability. Fabulous. Places like Duke, Chapel Hill, they don't need it because yeah. you got residents there 24/7. But and you've got a hospital out there in the middle of nowhere, mm-hmm. small hospital, and they can't afford it. But it really has saved a lot of money. But that's where technology mm-hmm. has just turned that whole area around.
You know, one of the things that I hear all of y'all talking about is innovation and technology. And one of the, for consumers, for healthcare consumers, one of the things that has created is a glut of information. Mm-hmm. People can use what's at their fingertips to diagnose themselves, to think they understand the etiology of some disease, to decide whether they need surgery or not, to decide whether they should get care or not. In what ways has, you know, the flood of medical and healthcare-related information helped patients, and in what ways has it hurt it?
So my nightmare was the patient walks in. I walk in the door and the patient's sitting there with about an inch thick stack of paper. Mm-hmm. And they've read all about heart surgery. And, well, why are you going to do this? And why don't you do it that way? And what about this? And that's and people should be educated. But, it, you know, it takes about 9 years to become a heart surgeon. So I can't teach you that in the next 15 minutes while we're talking. But I don't have any issue with people informing themselves. And we they should be informed, but they should act on it, and we should educate them how to act on it. There's no question that you can improve your health.
How do you teach nurses to disabuse patients of their own diagnostic inabilities?
We don't. We don't teach them to do that. We teach them, as Chancellor Cummins says, to incorporate that into the decision that you're making because it's their health
yeah.
and their life. I think one of my biggest concerns about it isn't that people come in too educated. Even though when I was working mm-hmm. as a nurse practitioner, I had people come in, tell me what drug they needed, and, you know, I didn't need to really look in their ears. But the, or listen to their heart, you know, that was okay. But the, but we have now a widening gap, and I'm sure that the, when Chancellor Cummins was in rural health and with the Medicare system, saw that we have a widening gap between those who have access to all the technology we're discussing and those who don't. That's why they went to the critical mm-hmm. access hospitals and knew that. Some right. research shows very clearly that if I have a communication with my provider, like through my portal, and lots of, we have portals in Robeson County, but we seem to have difficulty getting people to use them. So I'm encouraging nursing students to ask, are you using this? Let me mm-hmm. teach you how to use that. Let me help you learn how to be a consumer of healthcare and a consumer of health information.
With all the pharmaceuticals, a lot of people are waiting for that next drug mm-hmm. to treat Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. And I've been in a room full of angry 70-plus-year-olds saying, How come
where's my pill?
They can't make the pill for this. They can treat erectile dysfunction, and that was developed in a few years, and nothing for Alzheimer's. I keep telling them the brain's a little more complicated than the other part of the body. And it may not be the magic drug for Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is one of the most complicated diseases out there. There's so many genes involved and different proteins, and everybody's different. You have 100 billion neurons and 500 billion other cells that make each brain with different complications. So it may be natural products and lower your risk factors of other issues, and that's why people are now looking at the microbiome and every process, how much sugar you drink every day that might even increase your risks.
In about the last half century, the portion of U.S. healthcare expenses paid directly by consumers went from about half down to about 11% out of pocket. Government paid expenditures for healthcare went from about a quarter to about a half, and private insurance increased from about 21% to 33%. How has this impacted the delivery of healthcare, the ability to solve questions in changing the nature of how healthcare gets paid? A lot of you have talked about affordability and cost related to it. How are we more able to deliver healthcare to the people that need it with all of the new technology, or do we seem in some ways less likely to have that family doctor relationship?
In mental health, you still have difficulty with access with all of these changes. Individuals have insurance. Unfortunately, the mental health insurance is still not being covered, right? Or the insurance companies dictate how much a psychologist gets paid, or how many sessions they think you should have based on whatever their number is. And they never went to school to know how many sessions it might take to treat a certain disorder, understand the severity of it. So you do have that problem. Also within mental health, most people still go see their general practitioner, right? And unfortunately, you have about 40 to 50% of individuals not being diagnosed correctly or not being referred correctly when they have a mental health problem. So I think we need to have integrated healthcare where at these primary practices, we have access to mental health providers. And I think that would vastly improve treatment of mental health.
What about the rest of y'all? Integrated healthcare?
I think we're beginning to see that in with our FQHC here in Robson Healthcare Corporation. Even at the veteran CBOC where we use to train our students or educate our students. You have a social worker or a nurse, you have a team approach with working with patients. Now, the cost of that is expensive. I don't think any of us in this room came cheaply. Maybe I did, but but anyway, the whole idea of how do we then pay for that, and the way we're going to do that is move that consumer where they look at their role and moving into prevention and health promotion, being willing to, when a research article comes out about how many sweet drinks you're drinking a day, if you're drinking four, you're doubling your chances of being diabetic, or two, right? Yeah. So it's the whole idea of, but then to tell people, well, you know, you had two glasses of sweet tea at dinner last night.
Right.
You need to go down to a half a glass of sweet tea. They really can give you some strange looks.
Mm-hmm. So in Medicaid, it's a very expensive system. It's an expensive way to take care of people, and unfortunately that's because politics, and you have a bureaucracy there where you've got the federal government, the state government, the local government. You've got 110 providers in North Carolina fighting over a $14 billion budget. And so sometimes the patient gets lost in all of that. But we really, what we tried to do at Medicaid and what I tried to do before at that point when I worked with something called Community Care of North Carolina was to get people more involved in their health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to realize that if I drink that sugary tea or whatever it is, that's not a good thing. And if I eat nothing but red meat three times a day, that's not a good thing. But now when you have that knowledge, you got to act on it. And you know, do you get out and do you go and run and exercise? And so we had a model with Community Care where we tried to get the patient more involved mm-hmm. in their health care. and trying to be proactive. And so we really need a healthcare system in America that's centered around health and not disease. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we could change that mindset, unfortunately, there's a lot more money in disease
right.
than there is in health. And so how we make that happen, if we don't, though, it's going to bankrupt us. The year before I went to Medicaid, the Medicaid budget was $531 million over budget, $500 million over budget for a $14 billion bureaucracy. And what that meant, North Carolina has a balanced budget amendment, which means at the end of the year, the money you spend has got to equal the money you take in. So what happened? Places like UNC Pembroke, someone contacted, you need to send us some money. We need $1 million, we need $10 million, we need whatever, because we have to make up a $500 million budget hole in the budget. The year after that, just with minor tweaks to things, the next year we were $130 million over budget. We had $130 million under budget. We had $130 million good, and I just spoke with the Medicaid director, and he said last year they turned back in over $300 million to the state of North Carolina. Here's your money back. Thank you very much. And that's not covering fewer patients. That's not denying care. It's simply using common sense and doing some of the things that all of us here in this room would know to do. You've got to get the patient involved in their care. You cannot treat a person who's committed that they're not going to be treated, or who's committed to living an unhealthy lifestyle. You have
I'm
going to
drink my tea.
That's right.
Don't tell me I can't drink
and
my
then
tea.
Then when I drink my tea, I want a pill that will
That's
take
right.
care
right.
of
yes.
it.
Yeah.
And then when I get my diabetes, and then when I have my heart disease, I want an operation.
Right.
And one of the biggest financial burdens is the aging population. That's been said by many. And we're going to have to deal with the fact that people are living longer. People are working longer because they're living longer. And we have to worry about who's taking care of them into these later years. What's the mental health of the caregivers? I get phone calls in my office from caregivers say, I don't qualify for this level of funding because I make $5 extra, as they say, and I'm 70 with a heart attack taking care of my 92-year-old mother with Alzheimer's disease. So we need a dementia-friendly society. And we can solve some of that if 1% of all political contributions is set aside for Alzheimer's research.
Good luck with that.
1%.
Historically, Medicare and Medicaid came in the 1960s. And the initial estimates, within 10 years, the initial estimates of what the annual costs were off by, like, multiple millions of dollars. Nobody in their wildest imagination understood where it would go. And the problem is everybody wants their own parents covered, or their own grandparents, as the case may be. What people aren't necessarily sure of is whether they want to cover somebody else's grandparents. And that's where the dollars go quickly, and that's where the costs rise, because we want the new surgical technique, we want the new research, we want the state-of-the-art care, we want, you know, every holistic part of us covered, but we're not sure we want that for everybody, or we're not necessarily sure that we can deliver that in what we have to pay. One last question, and then we'll wrap up for today. One of the biggest issues in all of your different fields is communication. You know, different researchers working on diseases, communicating just enough with each other not to totally duplicate efforts. You know, a specialist communicating with a general practitioner about what's going on. Nurses being able to communicate with doctors if they have some specific ideas from being with patients. General practitioners communicating with mental health experts to say, I'm not sure if this person needs to see you or not. How can you help me? How do we get medical, healthcare, and patients talking to each other in a way in which the emphasis can be health and not disease? How do we get everybody on the phone together?
I think it starts with how we're educating our workforce. I was educated in a model where we did have a collaborative practice. And I think, you know, that's, you know, I know enough about Dr. Chancellor Cummins to know that he was a collaborative practitioner. So you've got to be willing to say, take a risk. I don't know it all, and I'm never going to know it all. And so it's okay. But then teaching that when a person's in school. And so it begins with, when we're practicing, we have nurses down in the Clinical Learning Center. Do I also have social work students in there? Do I also have biology students who are, and they're discussing an issue together? I think sometimes we may teach in silos more than we should. And I think by collaborating across disciplines as role models, as faculty, then it also will move into our students. And then particularly UNCP's mission in our community, then we become the leaders in seeing that with our other providers. Because they're looking to us. They want that assistance from us. That's been my experience.
Absolutely.
So a few decades ago, two decades ago, this idea of an electronic medical record came to the forefront and was very much resisted. I remember I was just out of my training, so I'm still fairly young, and there's no way I'm going to use a computer to treat my patient. And because, you know, you sit there with a computer, and all of a sudden I'm focused on the computer and not on the patient. And so now I want to interact with my patient. So there's a lot of resistance, and a lot of folks said, well, I'll just go ahead and retire. A lot of doctors said, I'll never do that. Well, guess what? Today, 95% plus folks are using electronic medical records. And the idea behind it is beautiful. I mean, if I had my own record and I show up at Duke, and I was just seen over at Southeastern yesterday, and we have everything that was done there, so we don't have to repeat it now at Duke. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing, and they know my history and they, the whole nine yards. But unfortunately, it's so hard to get that to work. It's a simple concept. When I was in Raleigh, we had, I think it was the Philippines, came, or some country, small country of about 15 million people came, and they wanted to learn from us. And we learned from them, because in their country, every person has this card, and you plug it in, and here are your allergies, here's your whole history right there. And so but you can do that when you've got a small group of people. When you're talking about 300 million and you've got all these disparate folks fighting and trying to get at the, you know, make a dollar and so forth, it's a lot more difficult.
It's going to be in your smartphone soon. Your smartphone has everything about you.
So in China, they had four companies selling electronic medical records. In America, we have 300. So if we could get that idea down that when I walk into the emergency room, here's my card, we would save lots of money, and patients would get better care, and we would have communication, et cetera. But
probably treat more patients in a given day, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's no question.
Well, we do that with our military. They have a chip that they carry with them that has all their even x-rays, everything on it. But like you say, it's a smaller... Yeah. And it's an integrated medical system. It's an integrated health system.
The federal government drives a lot of health care between Medicare, Medicaid,
VA.
You would think they could just say, this is the way it's going to happen, folks, period. Sorry, this is the way it's going to happen.
Well, if we solve the federal government issues, we really will deserve a vacation. Well, thank you all for your time today. Thanks to each of you on the panel, Dr. Ben Barr, Dr. Cherry Beasley, Dr. Robin Cummings, and Dr. Shilpa Regan. Thanks to all of you who are listening. Please pass 30 brave minutes along to someone else, and tune in next month for another discussion from the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke.
Today's podcast was produced by Dr. Richard Gay and transcribed by Ms. Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, or divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presented material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!